All right, before I start with our subject, I wanted to just spend a moment talking a bit about Jerisha, which is one of the sponsors for my coming here today. And I have a whole bunch of brochures that I left out in the front when you registered. I don't know if you got a chance to see them. There are many programs at Jerisha. Jerisha is an institute for higher learning in New York City. Rabbi Silber, who's the founder and dean, is also speaking here this morning. And Rabbi Helfgott also teaches at Jerisha, so we're kind of all coming from the same place. Jerisha has a number of options in the summertime for people who don't live in New York City. There's a program in June for college students and graduate students that's co-ed, and there's a program in July that's just for women, full-time learning. I highly recommend both of them for anybody who has free time in July to come and study full-time with fantastic women from around the world. Your skills will deepen tremendously, your exposure to Jews from around the world. Everything about the program is really, it will change your life. The other program I had an opportunity to speak to Ulpana students on Friday is a high school program that takes place in the summertime. That's a five-week program if you have daughters that are graduating 8th grade through 12th grade that would benefit from, again, being in an environment of Torah Lishma with other girls that are interested in learning and developing their skills. Take a look at this brochure, and I have copies, as I said, out in the front. All right. I did my duty. Okay. I want to talk to you this morning about a kind of sensitive topic. You'll realize just how sensitive it is the more we get into it, and I have taught this to a number of audiences. This is probably a more appropriate audience than ones in the past. We're talking about partying, talking about drinking, getting drunk. What the purpose of it is on Purim, I'm not going to stand here and say that you shouldn't get drunk, which is usually how shiurim go in advance of Purim. I'm not a pulpit rabbi, so I don't have those kinds of responsibilities. But I am a high school teacher, and I did give this shiur as my model lesson. Only now do I realize just how risky that was. My message was, it's good to get drunk. And we're going to talk about, at the end, if we have time, kind of where do we go with this message, if I convince you that this is a worthy cause, and we'll explain why it is that Chazal want us to do what we're supposed to do on Purim. How do we think about this kind of from a communal perspective, managing this with different age groups and different responsibilities as parents, as teachers, as communal leaders? So we're talking about the art of partying. And the reason why we're talking about partying is not just because Purim itself, the celebration of Purim, is so much defined by not just partying, but really the carnival. Right? It's the one day of the year where everything is upside down, where we don't do normal things. Those of us who have to go to work, I'm sorry, but those of us who don't, right? Purim is really a day where the rules are different, where we dress differently, we eat differently, we behave to our friends differently. Everything is literally upside down. And it all comes from the Megillah. The Megillah cannot be severed from the celebration of Purim, not just because we perform it literally by reading it twice on Purim Day, but the story itself is so intimately connected to our celebration of the holiday of Purim. And what I want to show you this morning is that the party in the Megillah, which is not called the Seuda, what is it called? The Mishteh, is such an important piece, not just of the narrative, but of the way that the story unfolds, that you cannot ignore how central the Mishteh is, nor can you ignore the obvious connections between the Mishteh and our Seuda. In fact, anyone want to guess how many Mishtaot there are in the Megillah? Two. What do you think? Three, at least four? 200? Well, depends. If you're counting the days, then it's even more than 200, right? But actual Mishtaot, you're going to see there are 10. Okay? 10 Mishtaot. How many chapters are there in the Megillah? 10. Okay? It turns out that Perek Yud is only 3 psukim. There's no party there. And the deepest, darkest Perek, Perek Dalid, where things can go one way or the other, also has no party. But other than that, every other parak has a mishteh. If we wanted to plot the Megillah along the mishteot, we could. Everything takes place in a party, in a mishteh. So let's start by looking at the Megillah and seeing what exactly the mishteh represents in the Megillah, and then we'll ask questions about our own suda. So if you look in Perek Aleph, Perek Aleph has quite a few parties. Perek Aleph actually begins with a party. I apologize, I only have the Hebrew, but if you do have a stone chumash, the Megillah should be in the back. In the English, I will translate all the psukim. Okay, so we're starting with Perek Aleph. The Megillah opens. I like to think of it almost, you know, when a movie begins and before there's any dialogue, it kind of zooms in on the colors, the jewels, right? You're getting a sense of the scene before anything happens. Well, the scene of the Megillah in Shushan is this opulent, over-the-top kind of party. The Megillah begins, Vayhi b'mei Achashverosh, Hu Achashverosh Hamolech Mehodu v'ad Kush, Sheva v'esrim u'meya Medina. We're introduced to the king and to the extent of his kingdom. Bayamim hahem, Keshevat HaMelech Achashverosh al kisei malchuto asher b'shushan habira. In those days when Achashverosh was presiding on his throne, that was in Shushan, his capital, Bishnat shalosh l'malcho asa mishteh l'chol sarav v'avadav, Chel parasu madai hapartamim v'sarei hamedinot lefanav. You notice the very first thing we find out about Achashverosh, besides his name and the number of provinces, is that he throws a party. Okay, the very first order of his kingdom, probably not the first thing he did because it's in his third year, but it's the first thing we find out about. And who does he make party number one for? Not for himself, it's for the Sarim and the Avadim, Chel Paras Madai, the inner circle. Okay? All of those who were serving in Shushan, he makes a mishteh. And then the purpose of that party is displayed in verse 4. Behar oto et osher kavod malchuto, ve'et yekar tiferet gdulato, yamim rabim shmonim uma'at yom. All right, so here you get the large number, whoever said 200, right? So how long was this party?
Half a year,
okay? 6 months of partying. This is clearly a joke, right? There's a lot in the Megillah that's comic. It's been called a farce or a parody, right? You begin with a king who throws a 180-day party, a six-month. I mean, we've got lots of criticism for our president in America. I'm not going to get political, but 6 months of partying, it's very hard to get anything done. Right? When that is the agenda of the kingdom. And what is his purpose? What did you catch from the beginning of the Pasuk? Why does he throw this party for his inner circle? To show off. To show off his wealth. And of course, don't forget, what we know about Achashverosh, not from the Megillah, but what we know from outside sources. How did he come to become the king? He married in, okay? He is insecure with his position. When people are insecure, they show off, right? They try to compensate. They try to show just how legitimate they are as the king. This is a 100-day party to his inner circle, to his cabinet, to show that he really is the king. He's in charge. Behar oto et osher kavod malchuto. Okay. Now, uvimilo'ot hayamim ha'ela, when these days were done, asa ha'melech l'chol ha'am ha'nimtza'im b'shushan ha'bira l'migadol v'ad katan, mishteh shivat yamim b'chatzar ginat bitan ha'melech. At the conclusion of the 180-day party, but who could count, right? What did he do? The very next thing he threw another party, and this was a modest one. It was only 7 days of partying, but it was for not just the inner circle, it was for everybody in Shushan. The next few psukim describe the extent of his ostentatious opulence, right? What he put on display for everybody. He didn't use paper or plastic, right? He put out, we have descriptions here, which of course remind us of this past week's Parsha, with all of the precious jewels that were in the breastplate of the Kohen. He put out his finest, most beautiful, colorful stock. So far we have in the Mishteh, we have opulence, we have ostentatiousness. We have insecurity masked as control. There's a kind of parody of what it means to be a ruler in the Mishteh. And the next thing we find out about the Mishteh in Pasuk Zayin, which you really only find out when you either hear it read or read the Midrash is the following. Vashkot bichlei zahav. Anyone mind if I sing it? Bichelim mikelim shonim. Right? What do we hear when it's leaned? Echa. Okay? In the middle of the Megillah, suddenly we hear Echa. The Echa trep there is a way of marking the Midrash, which says what about the Kelim mikelim shonim? They're from the Beit HaMikdash. Okay, on a kind of pshat level, what you could say about the Chelim Mekelim Shonim is that Ahasuerus was ahead of his time, and instead of having everything matchy-matchy, right, he had different pieces from different sets. That's how you could read it on a pshat level, Chelim Mekelim Shonim. But Chazal say no, it's not about his fashion statement. The Kelim Shonim, they are shoneh because they don't belong to him. In fact, how did he get them? We say the Beit HaMikdash, but remember, Persia didn't destroy the Beit HaMikdash, the first Beit HaMikdash. Who did? The Babylonians did, and then the Persians quickly took over the Babylonians. So there's almost more of an estrangement, right? Think about the insult. These Kelim have now changed hands twice. They belong to us as the readers, and clearly to the Jews in Shushan, and there they are on display in his Mishteh. So in Pasuk Zion, in addition to the kind of tinge of sadness that we hear as the readers, there is a marker that the Mishteh excludes the Jews. Okay, meaning this has nothing to do with whether or not Jews were there, which is a discussion in the Midrash, whether they were invited or not. But the marker of the Kelim Mekelim Shonim shows right away that the Mishteh is about, right, superiority of Persia over and against the Jewish people. Pasuk Chet, there's a very strange rule, and of course, dat, rule, law, in the Megillah is another way of parodying the Persian Empire, right? The only rule at the party was you can't force anybody. They can drink as much as they want. We always say that at our own Seuda. Kikein yisad ha-melech al kol rav beito la'asot kirtzon ish va'ish. Everybody needs to do as they want. Okay, so far we have two parties. One was for the inner circle, one is for the larger population of Shushan. We have insecurity, opulence, parity, and exclusion of Jews. What's the third party? Vashti. Very tsanua, right? Vashti makes a separate party for the women. Of course, she is the rightful heir, right, as we know. Gam Vashti hamaka asta mishte nashim beit hamalchut asher lamelech Ahasuerus. Now, in Pasuk Yud, on the seventh day, which is really, pardon me, the 187th day, he's finally drunk. Right? Kitov lev hamelech bayayin, what happens, we all know. Right? It's the story that's so confusing to teach to young children. Because we tell them not to do things. Right? To say no when people ask them to do things that they find appropriate. But then Vashti gets killed. She's a very confusing heroine for young children. I'm dealing with this right now with my four-year-old girl who's not sure who she sides with, Vashti or Esther. What? Okay, well, she's certainly, whether or not it's off with her head, she's certainly off out of the kingdom. Right? Okay, she doesn't get killed. But she is not allowed to stay in the kingdom. She's X'd out of the story. We never hear from her again. Okay, that at least you'll give me, right? Even if she's not killed. So what happens at this party? What does Mishteh represent? It also represents lewdness. It represents violence. It's a place where rash decisions are made. I mean, the queen refuses to do what the king wants of him, and of her rather, and he says, get rid of her. Get rid of her. Okay. So we have party one, two, and three. Party number four takes us to Perek Bet. Now, Perek Bet, after Esther, after the beauty pageant, and Esther is chosen, Pasuk Yitzayin, Vayahav HaMelech et Esther mikol hanashim, Vatisachin v'chesed lefanav mikol habitulot, Vayasem ketzer machut berosha, Vayamlicheha tachat Vashti. So he loves her, he adores her above all the women. Of course, again, not really the values that we want to communicate love based on looks. And he chooses her, and he puts the crown on her head. And then what does he do? He makes a party. Pasuk Yirchad, Vayas HaMelech Mishte Gadol Lechol Sarav Avadav Et Mishte Esther V'Hanacha Lamdinot Asa V'Yitein Mas'et Kiyad HaMelech. As a result of his gladness, his joy at having found a new queen, what does he do? Tax relief, right? He gives them an exemption from taxes during the time of the party for Esther. But again, we find, and those who were just in Rabbi Helfgott's shir, talking about Mordechai, Yoshev Bishar HaMelech, right after this Mishteh, again, we hear about the exclusion of the Jews. In this sense, it's confusing, because Esther, of course, is not only the subject of the party, the reason for the party, but she is the guest of honor, but of course, she's not revealing who she is. So it's a party which is not a true party, because he doesn't know who Esther is. And even more so, Mordechai is right outside. He's Yoshev B'Shar HaMelech. Now, Mordechai functions in the Megillah, and this I really borrow from my teacher, Rabbi Silber. Mordechai really functions as the quintessential insider Jew, right? He's the one who is always in the know about what's happening Jewishly. He's the one who resists the lure of Haman. However, we understand why he did not bow down. And he is the one who's always dressed in Jewish garb and sitting outside. He's sitting just at the gate. He's not inside the palace. So we find out again that the Mishteh represents the exclusion of the Jew in Esther's party. Now, the darkest party, if you will, is in chapter 3. Esther Perek Gimel, after Achashverosh agrees to Mordechai's plan, look at Pasukit Gimel, V'nishloach Sfarim B'yad HaRatzim, El Kol Medinot HaMelech, L'Hashmid, L'Harog, U'L'Abed, El Kol HaYehudim, Minar V'ad Zakein, Taf HaNashim B'yom Echad, B'Shloshah Zay L'Chodesh Neim Asar, U'Chodesh Adar, U'Shlalam Lavoz. The decision was made, right, that on the 13th day of Adar, that the Jews, all the Jews, and it's very graphic, right, men, women, children, would be destroyed, three verbs that are used to destroy the Jews, and the messengers were sent out. Everybody will be ready for that day. Skipping to Pasuk Tadva, verse 15, Haratzim yatzu dechufim bidvar hamelech, vehadat nitna b'shushan habira, vehamelech vehaman yashvu lishtot, vehair shushan navocha. That's the party everyone misses, right? It's so private. But when all of the messengers are racing out in a hurry to deliver the matter of the king, and the law was given in Shushan Habira, meanwhile, the king and Haman, what do? They sit down to drink. They have a private mishteh. And again, it can't be more clear, the exclusion of the Jews, the ha'ir Shushan Navocha. And again, the vav there should be translated as but. Right? While the king and Haman were getting drunk and partying, meanwhile, the Jews were a mess. Right? They were besides themselves. The ha'ir Shushan, by the way, interesting, just noticed it right now, the ear is not really the ear, it's the Jews of Shushan. Yeah.
Well, I don't know why you're meaning the city, because I understood the meaning of this was that the general populace, they were kind of surprised that it was me, because they maybe didn't have the same animus that
could be.
Haman had.
Could be. Could be, right? That would be a very generous read, right? But it's possible, right, that actually everybody was confused, because it does seem random. Right? This was Haman's own problem. Bewildered. Bewildered. Yeah.
Actually, the text goes out of its way to make the populace innocent throughout the whole story.
Right. They're innocent, except that we don't get any sense that they were resistant.
That's only in the Midrash.
No, meaning there's no voice of opposition when the dot comes out, with the exception of this one phrase that we want to read ear as everybody, right?
This could be a voice of opposition.
Good. Okay. It could be a hint of opposition, not about a voice. Yeah.
But we actually have information later in the Megillah that they are actively supporting the decree because they gather themselves and get ready to destroy the Jews. The text tells us that. So, you know, when it says the city is in an uproar, does it mean that they are terrified or maybe they're excited?
All right. We'll leave that. We'll think about that some more. Back to the parties. Okay, the matter at hand. Like I said, Perek Dalid has no parties. That's the Perek that's missing on this source sheet. And what happens to Perek Dalid, I have to say every year when I read it, it becomes more and more of a frightening Perek to me, because things could have turned out totally differently. Right? What happens to Perek Dalid is when, again in Rabbi Silber's terms, the insider Jew talks to the outsider Jew, or as he puts it, also the assimilated Jew versus the inside Jew. After all, this is the story of the Galut. And what happens in Perek Dalet when Mordechai comes and tells Esther, Esther is the only Jew in the entire Shushan that doesn't know about the proclamation, right? Which would also be further support that Vayir is the Jews and not everybody. Esther doesn't even know about the proclamation. Mordechai tells her that everybody is besides themselves. And what's her basic answer at first to Mordechai? Can't do anything. Can't do anything. Now, Esther, again, is hiding her identity, but she lives very much inside the palace. She understands the workings of the palace, and she's right. She can't do anything, right? She cannot go to the king unless she has been summoned. And her response to Mordechai comes from her knowledge of the inner workings of the palace. But what's Mordechai's response to her? Mi odeya, right? We don't know. We don't live in a time of nevuah. We don't have clear indication from God that this is what we must do. But when we live in the galut, we fumble around, right? We do our best to read the signs. And Mordechai says, Esther, you got to try. Wait, good. Well, not really. You'll see what she, in a way, what Esther does, right, once in that, again, those pivotal psukim, which we don't have on the sheet, when there is that pause, in a way, right, when Mordechai is talking to Esther and trying to convince her, and it could have gone either way, when she says, all right, and she moves into action, she's able to save the Jewish people because she knows how the palace works. Not only does she have access to, as we'll see, the Mishteh, but she also has access to what exactly is going on with Ahasuerus, what his fears and insecurities are, and she has access to the fears and insecurities of Haman. So again, what we see, the reason why this is such a powerful Galut narrative, besides the absence of God and the absence of a clear roadmap, is we need all Jews working together. Right? Everybody, all of our kinds of knowledge, all of our kinds of insights are essential in being able to steer us towards a Jewish future. That's what we need. We need to keep that in mind for ourselves today. It's not just insider and it's not just outsider, however you define inside and outside. So when Esther starts to get busy with her roadmap, what does she do? She invites the king to a party together with Haman. She uses the institution of the palace, which is the Mishteh. Now, what does she know about Ahasuerus, and what does she know about Haman that she manipulates so well by inviting them to a private Mishteh?
At first, she knows they like drinks.
Okay.
Okay,
good. Good. She knows with Haman particularly, right, that he is interested in advancement. He's being invited to a private Mishteh with the king and the queen. He's going to be all puffed up, even more than he already is, right? What about the king?
He likes to drink,
okay, but it's more than that. What is she trying to get him to think? She's starting to make him a little bit nervous.
That he can have an intimate moment
with her, but with Haman also.
That's
right, that's exactly the problem. What is Haman doing at that Mishteh? Okay, she's starting to plant the seeds of suspicion in the mind of Ahasuerus. He would have been very happy if it was a private party, an intimate romantic dinner for two, but it's suddenly Haman is there, and he's starting to think, which we see how well she plays that, because what happens in the second Mishteh, right? She's successful at pointing out Haman, so much so that when he walks outside, right, and remember the famous, again, this is a comic scene, right? But Haman is begging Esther, he's falling over her. Ahasuerus walks out, and the first thing he thinks is, oh my God, you're trying to get my wife right here while I'm in the palace. That was exactly the suspicion that she was trying to place in his mind all along. So Esther is responsible for two parties, party 6 and party 7, both of which are her ways of getting the king and Haman to do what needs to be done by playing into their fears and insecurities. So again, Esther, who is clearly the Jewish queen, she's using the paradigm of the Mishteh from inside the palace to begin to turn around the Jewish story. Perek Dalet, one more time, which doesn't have a Mishteh, is the turning point. And from here on in, the Mishtaot that are called by Jews, starting with Esther, and they're starting to work the Mishteh for their own purposes. Party number 8 is in chapter 8 on the bottom. Actually, your sheet might look different than mine. chapter 8, verse 15, Tedvav. Mordechai yatza milifnei hamelech bilvush malchut zechelet vachor v'ateret zahav gedola v'tachrichbut v'argaman v'ha'ir shushan sahala v'samecha la'yehudim ha'ta'ora v'simcha v'sason v'yikar u'v'chol medina u'medina u'v'chol ir v'ir makom asher dvar hamelech v'dato magia simcha v'sason la'yehudim mishteh v'yom tov v'rabim me'ameh ha'aretz mityahadim ki nafal pachad ha'yudim alayhem. In chapter 8, we have an incredible reversal from the beginning of the Megillah. First of all, we have reference to some of those beautiful, fine materials, which were in Perek Aleph, right? In Achashverosh's Mishteh. Here now, Mordechai is wearing them. Of course, he is literally and physically embodying, right, the new role that he is playing. He is no longer the Jew in Jewish garb. He has broken free, right? And he is wearing the Persian royalty clothing. And here, instead of the Ha'ir Shushan Navocha, we have the Ha'ir Shushan Tzahala V'Sameicha, and then, more specifically, the Jews are jubilant. Why? They've heard the news of the new dot. Right? Again, we all know that the parody in Persia, and this clearly is poking fun at all the laws of the Persian Empire. Nothing can ever be rescinded. Any law that is put out there can only be revoked when a new law is put out. You can't run an empire like that, right? But the new law is that now the Jews can kill their enemies. And the Jews have a mishteh, the Yom Tov. They have their own mishteh, not yet at the victory, but just at the news. What does that remind us of? The private mishteh of Achashverosh and Haman. Before anything happened, right, they were celebrating while the messengers were going out. Now the Jews are celebrating while the messengers are going out with their reverse decree. That's party 8. Finally, parties 9 and 10 are the parties that the Jews celebrate after they're victorious of their enemies. And again, it's a nice reversal of Perek Aleph. First, we have the party of the Jews everywhere, right, who fought their enemies. And then only at the end, the final party is the Jews of Shushan, right? So again, reversing backwards, like Achashverosh's first party was the inner circle, and then the wider circle, the Jews, it closes in the opposite direction. So we're left with the Jews in Shushan having the final party. And their party is, in verse Yudtet, Pasuk Yudtet, Simcha u'mishteh v'yom tov u'mishloach manot ish lere'ehu. That we didn't see, right? Sending to your friends, that seems to be the popular Jewish contribution. And more importantly, in Pasuk Chavbet, the very, very, very last party that doesn't take place in the Megillah, but it's institutionalized, so I wouldn't really call a party 11, but it's future-oriented. When Mordechai writes down all these words and codifies the practices that the Jews in Shushan and elsewhere did that year and says, okay, from now on, do this again, what does he add? Matanot Levuni. Right? So Mordechai, again, as the card-carrying Jew, helps the people frame their mishteh differently so that it's not just about partying and celebration and sending treats to their friends, but also taking care to provide for the poor. The mishteh, yemei mishteh v'simcha mishloach manot ish l'reihu matan l'avyonim, that's of course what we do when we celebrate our Suda. Okay, so now we're ready for the question. The question is, all right, you're convinced, right? The mishteh is very important in the Megillah. It starts out as a Persian emblem. Esther, through her knowledge of the court, is able to turn it around in order to save the Jewish people. And by the end of the Megillah, the Jews, who originally were excluded, Mikelim, Mikelim, Shonim, and Perek Aleph, have fully taken on this institution and the celebration and the practice of the Mishteh in their own victory over their enemies. So the question is, when we come to our own celebration of Purim, why do we create a Seudah? Are we, okay, what's a simple answer? Lezecher. Lezecher what? What exactly are we trying to memorialize? Okay, so a very simple answer is to say, you know, we bypass all those early mishtot. We're not trying to mimic or recall or, right, remember the mishtot from the first half of the Megillah. What we're doing simply is we are performing right? The Mishteh, like the Jews did in Shushan, and it's not quite that different than other Chagim, if you think about it. What are we doing? We're reenacting the events. What else do we do around Purim that you could support that theory? What do we do before Purim? We fast, okay? We fast like Esther, so we get ourselves ready, right? We kind of go through the motions of Esther. What else do we do? Okay, Parshat Zachor, which is a little bit of a later, but getting us prepped, right, this past Shabbat. We read the Megillah twice, which is another way of, again, enacting, reenacting the story. We send Mishloach Manot, etc., etc. All right, that's possible. And what we're doing with our Mishteh is we're effectively collapsing the centuries that separate us from the Jews of Shushan and saying, we're just like you, right? We are now experiencing what you experienced, much like we do in Leil HaSeder and Pesach. Problem is that our Seuda, right, on Purim, is not so dissimilar in some ways from the early Mishta'ot. Meaning, first of all, think about the wider web that the Seuda is the culmination of the day. And what we're doing is we are poking fun, right, on some level, at Persia. Why? V'nahafochu, right? We're poking fun at all the rules by dressing up, by doing skits. We put on display just how much fun we can make of our order of our life, just like the Megillah is making fun of Persia. But there's also an element of almost psychological release at the carnival, right? I like this word very much from anthropology, liminality, right? Living on the borders, living on the edges. It's kind of like what we do at our Seuda is like Lahavdil, a New Year's Eve party. Why? We're living at the time when, right, we're in between zones. When we dress up and we show ourselves in different kinds of ways, we are making a lot of noise, acting crazy at the borders, at the fear, right? The insecurity, remember, of Achashverosh that we are now putting on display. But the real problem comes with the fact, if you look at your last source, that we have an obligation. Libesume bepuria, azelo yada ben arur haman lebaruch Mordechai. Now, I would have said, going on your first answer, right? Okay, we have a Seuda as a commemoration of the Mishteh, but actually our job on Purim should be make it very clear that we are who we are and they are who they are. It should be a day all about boundaries. It should be a day where it's very clear that we have superseded them. Our Mishteh has now taken the place of the Mishteh of Achashverosh, and we should celebrate our difference. Why are we asked to get to the point where we don't know the difference between the villain and the hero? How does that make any sense? What analogy do we have in our calendar or in our halakha where we're actually asked to stop knowing the difference and to live in that blurriness, to live in that kind of gray period? And why the drinking? Now, again, this is kind of the sensitive part that I started with. I'm speaking in a kind of ideal vacuum, okay? I'm not getting drunk this year, obviously. But the ideal vacuum that I'm talking about is when people can drink to the point where they're not vomiting and doing disgusting things and getting violent and all the things that, unfortunately, we've seen and heard about that can happen on Purim, particularly for adolescents. But a way of drinking where people let go of themselves just enough that they're able to see different parts of themselves, where they're able to see that, in fact, what we're doing on Purim, what we're asked to do on Purim, is to get to that Hasidic statement of Purim ke Yom Kippurim, right? Always troubled by that? Do a Google search on it. You'll find so many websites that deal with that phrase, that Hasidic statement. How on earth is Purim like Yom Kippur? I can't think of two more opposite days. Why are they similar? What I would like to suggest is that what we do in Yom Kippur, in a way, is we accept and we celebrate and we think about just how much we're not in control of our lives. Hashem is in control of our lives. And Yom Kippur, through our liturgy, we all get to that point, right? Whether it's through tears or whether it's through joy, where we recognize that ultimately we don't know what's coming in the year to come, and we submit to the ultimate authority of God. For many people, Yom Kippur is an easy day. For many people, Yom Kippur is a hard day, right? Depending on your temperament and your past and your disposition, some people can connect to that way of understanding God's control of our lives better through prayer, silence, abstinence of food. Purim is trying to get you to the same goal through the opposite means. Right? Why? On Purim, when you let go a little bit, when you drink to the point of not being totally in control of yourself, but again, with limitations, what happens? You start to realize, or you enact, you put on display, that ultimately you're not in control of your life. And I think for many adults, Purim is a harder day than Yom Kippur. Right? We like to think of Purim as a kid's holiday. Kids have a super easy time getting into Purim. We're really bad at it because we spend our lives working very hard to maintain and create control of our lives, right? Our Blackberries, our iPhones, our schedules, everything. We can't live without our order. And we can lull ourselves into the myth that actually we are in control of what's coming next. Purim is a shock day. Purim is a day where through joy and drink and silliness, we're asked to really live in that scary zone where we recognize that God is in control and we are not in control. And what looks to us like the villain really might be the hero, and what looks to us to be the hero might really be the villain. I'm seeing some nods and some stunned faces. That's kind of typical, right? I'm asking of us to do something that's very difficult. And in fact, and this is where, if we have some time at the end, I want to talk to you a little bit about kind of the practicalities of this. How do you do this? How do you make this happen in a way that's appropriate when you have multiple ages, right? But Purim, again, is, I think, on some level for many adults, more difficult than Yom Kippur, because the means to get to that end of recognizing that God is in control of our lives and not us is uncomfortable, right? So if we come back to the opening question of why the Su'udah is modeled on the Mishteh, it's not just a supersessionist argument. We're not just accessing and celebrating the end of the Megillah, where it was clearly a Jewish institution. We're actually coming back, in a way, to the carnivalesque excess, right? The Mishtaot of Achashverosh, where anything was possible. We're asked to partake of that a little bit, too. And we're asked to use that, though, L'shem Shamayim. We're asked to use that in a way so that our Su'udah becomes a place of transformation. Right, one more point, and then I want to take comments. If you think about it for a moment, our Su'udah, just to support this, yes, we wash and we bench, right? But there really are no other ritual things that are asked of us at a Su'udah. It doesn't look like a Su'udah of a regular yuntif. We don't have to have Lecha Mishnah, right? We don't have Zmirot in the formal way. We're not really dictated what to eat, or It's a Su'udah, it's a time zone that's dedicated to Mechayev Inish Lipsume Bipuria Adelo Yada Ben Aruhaman Lebaruch Mordechai. And I will just add, again, for those who are really weary of alcohol, there are ways of doing this without alcohol, right? There are ways of getting yourself to a place where you're able to see, right, different parts of yourself, show different parts of yourself to other people without the aid of alcohol. It doesn't have to be, although the halacha says, okay, I'm not giving suggestions. I'm sure people have ideas. We'll see, right? How do you do it? Alcohol makes it very easy, okay? So Chazal were giving us a kind of, a cheat sheet to get right there. But Purim also, and this is, I got to say, I'm married to a Purim Jew. So I couldn't have given this shiur 10 years ago, 12 years ago, because I didn't understand Purim at all. But he has taught me. He's a Purim Jew because he lives a little bit of Purim. Don't get the wrong idea. He lives a little bit of Purim every day, which means that our Shabbos table also asks of us to let go a little bit, see each other, show ourselves in other kinds of ways. Purim is a model for the rest of the year, just like Yom Kippur is. You can't live in Purim all the time. You can't live in Yom Kippur all the time. But that day gives you ideas for the rest of the year. How do I take some of this with me so that every time I sit down, I can share of myself? Every time I sit down, I can recognize that truly Hashem is in control and not me. Right? Purim is an extreme day. Yom Kippur is an extreme day. But there are ways of giving us ideas and models for the rest of the year. Yeah.
Self-analysis and test on the message and so on. And that on Purim,
process of repentance, and in fact, even if you haven't done it for repentance, you will still be aided. Also on Purim, when it's very difficult to be happy, given this context of, you know, remarkable betrayingness, God will also aid you in the process of trying to find the simcha and the ability, like, to add what you were saying, to let go of control and recognize that God is not in the world, similar to the way it is in the antithesis.
Beautiful. It's beautiful. That's a very extreme scenario, right, that you're describing, but we, some of us really do need help one way or the other. Right? And it comes back to the Megillah in a way, I'm adding to what you're adding, that the Megillah is a story of partnership. Right? It's a very quiet partnership with God. You have to look for it. God doesn't announce God's self in the Megillah, but very clearly when you read it, knowing what happens at the end, Mordechai and Esther are working together with Hashem. So too, like you're suggesting, we get the help when we need it. To do what needs to happen on Purim. Yeah.
I have a little bit of difficulty understanding why parties, the exclusion of the Jews, why is put that in a negative way? It was always my understanding that the Jews participated so wholeheartedly and that was the negative point there. The fact that they are not there, perhaps they chose not to be there, I would kind of view it more positively.
Okay, good. Okay, good. So in the Ketuv, right, in the Pshat, we don't have an indication of whether or not they were participating, right? That, you're right. That belongs in the Midrash in a discussion of a criticism of the Jews, that they were already assimilated, that they wanted to be at the party. What I was showing was on the level of the Pshat, what we see is that initially in the Megillah, the Mishteh is not just a symbol of all these empty values or scary values that Achashverosh is exposing, but it also works as a symbol, as an exclusion of the Jews. And later, you're right, in a positive way, mostly successfully, Esther is able to reappropriate the Mishteh. And it becomes the Jewish symbol by the end of the Megillah. It's another way of showing how the Jews are victorious by working within the empire. Correct. Correct. Yes. I wasn't talking about real Jews. I was talking about how it functions literarily. Yeah. Good question. Anyone have ideas?
Hazal go out of their way to be ambivalent about Mordechai, but they're never ambivalent about Haman. Haman is the real thing, through and through. There's no ambivalence about Haman. Not in all of the Midrashic literature and everything, but Mordechai ought to have
it. It's a really interesting question. I'm going to speak not, I can't, you know, support this across the board, but in general, when Chazal deal with extremes, right, if you think of our biblical personalities, Esav and Yaakov, think of other villains, there is certainly a tendency to vilify in an extreme way and expose the foibles of our heroes. So we're much more comfortable talking about, you know, what was difficult for Yaakov, what was difficult for David HaMelech. But it's true, Amalek, Haman, Esav become, you know, even more emblematic. You look in the Ketuv, you don't really feel as if there's room to make them so terrible. But that's an interesting question. I want to think about that some more. Yeah.
There is actually a source that says, so it sounds like he also has a redemption.
Very.
Could you repeat that?
Yeah, I didn't hear it. Can you say it again? But all his children were killed. But, all right, maybe his daughters. Maybe there were grandchildren before the kids were killed. Okay, it doesn't really matter. That's one of those midrashim that if you start to work it out practically, you get into trouble. That's not the point. The point is that perhaps, like you're saying, even in Haman, who is the darkest of the dark, there is the possibility of tshuva, which would be a different kind of message. Yeah. Well, the Suda is the rabbinic word.
I know,
Right? So it's a development of language thing, I think, more than it being a rupture in the idea of it.
Rabbis would have been happy to call him Mishter if they did many other things continuing, if there wasn't something behind. That's one thing.
Okay.
You also have to ask the question historically why, in pre-1948 Sephardic life, all of these things didn't exist. They mostly existed amongst Ashkenazi. The Suda existed.
So what's your theory?
Christian influence. Mardi Gras and Carnival has a huge influence. I think there's no doubt that originally Carnival got some of its origins from us. But after a while, since we were the minority culture, Carnival had a huge influence on us, especially the loss of control.
Good. I'd be very curious to think about this some more. My husband's actually a Sephardic studies professor, so I'm going to ask him about this. But if you think about it, like we were saying, that Purim is an opportunity to almost squelch the insecurity by asserting control. That would make a lot of sense in the Ashkenazi context when the outside world was clearly indicating otherwise. Purim would be a really important day to celebrate because you feel as if, no, we are the heroes. We are celebrating. Things are upside down in a very real way. You might not have the same need if you were living in a comfortable environment. Good.
Mm-hmm. Right, the deep and bitter outcry, which is what Esau left out when he discovers that he's been snookered by Yaakov, and then it happens again in the Megillah. And so the Midrash associates this and says that Esau's claim was finally adjudicated in the events of the Megillah.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also a tendency among Chazal to make things neat,
right?
And really show how narratives are long lasting and coming back upon themselves. Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah.
I prefer to explain the last sentence, Amaraba, in another way. Add the loyada. You can dream, feel, you feel that you cannot distinguish between Haman and Mordechai. Not more than that.
Okay, good. That's still hard to do, right? And you have to know yourself very well, right? And that's why I think, you know, if you want to take that approach, Purim is an ongoing challenge. Each year we get better at it, right? So some years maybe we slip beyond, and some years we go, we're too shy. So, you know, eventually we get it right, and we get right to that point of just before we're not clear, okay? But even approximating that blurriness is shocking in a way, and a different kind of experience than the rest of the year. Yeah. That's right. And we also, again, to extend that, we are embracing the fact that we always wear masks, right? But we don't allow ourselves to really admit it. So on Purim, we very physically put one on to help us see how every day we have all kinds of masks and persona, right? Right. So it's more training. Right, exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It seems that it's a very, very important part.
Right. Because it has, if we're going with our reading, right, there's the national import and there's also the personal psychological import. We can't really do without Purim in our calendar. All right. Thank you all very much. This was a lot of fun. Purim Sameach.